Cells that behaved like embryonic stem cells without using any embryo-derived materials. These new cells, dubbed induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPSs, could then be converted into a variety of different cell types, such as pancreas, muscle, or brain cells. The iPSs were created by inserting certain genes into the DNA of the adult cells. The inserted genes turn on cellular signals that allow the cell to change into new cell types. This breakthrough brings us closer to exciting possibilities, such as custom-designed treatments, drugs, or tissue transplant using stem cells made from the patient's own cells. This moment of science comes from Indiana University, with production support from the Office of the Provost. Today's program was prepared by Sue Ann Zollinger, with help from Kenneth Nephew in the Medical Sciences Program. I'm Yael Cassander.
WILL programs are made possible by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra, presenting Old Friends and New Faces on Saturday, October 17th at 7:30 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Paul Vermeil will be guest conductor and is joined by cellist Dmitry Kozov.
In sports this afternoon, fans of the Chicago Blackhawks had a great time last night watching their team tie an NHL record for the largest comeback in league history. The Hawks trailed Calgary 5-0 in the first period before roaring back for a 6-5 overtime win. The Philadelphia Phillies advanced to the National League Championship Series last night when they eliminated Colorado from the divisional series in Game 4. The Phillies scored three times in the top of the ninth to beat the Rockies 5-4 and will now face the Dodgers in the best-of-seven NLCS. It looks like the St. Louis Cardinals are parting ways with outfielder Rick Ankiel, who's due for free agency. Manager Tony La Russa has advised him to look for the best deal. Ankiel saw reduced playing time down the stretch and batted .231 with 11 homers and 38 RBIs for the season. And the Chicago Bulls will host the Milwaukee Bucks tonight in a preseason game. And that's our look at sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Theater Council, presenting An Evening with David Sedaris, author, humorist, and frequent contributor to NPR and This American Life, live at the Virginia Theater on Friday, October 16th at 8 p.m. Ticket information at 217-356-9063.
It's 2:43. The healthcare debate is devouring a lot of energy in Washington, so it makes sense that the world is concerned that the U.S. might show up at the global climate talks in December empty-handed. Conrad Wilson explains how the healthcare debate is threatening the chances of a global climate treaty.
European countries, along with China and other big global polluters, are wrestling with how to deal with global warming. But as the world gears up for the climate change conference in Copenhagen, Washington is focusing on healthcare. The timing of Washington's healthcare debate has many countries scratching their heads, and it has environmentalists and climate change folks nervous. All agree healthcare is important, but globally they say it's out of step. And when you ask Americans what the president's working on, few mention climate change.
Probably healthcare and fixing the economy.
On the economy and fixing the economy. Actually, I'll change that. Actually, what I think he's focusing on is the healthcare issue.
This week, Afghanistan. Last week, healthcare. The week before, the economy.
He's focusing on healthcare primarily, which is very important, but he also needs to maintain his focus on the economy.
What's not being talked about is climate change and the global talks coming up in Copenhagen. Dan Atsi is a professor of environmental law and policy at Yale University. He also has experience as a climate negotiator. Atsi predicts the healthcare debate will continue through the end of the year.
I think it's going to be very difficult, given the political effort that's going to be required to achieve success on healthcare, to imagine that climate change can be taken on during the same time period.
Atsi says there's only so much President Obama and members of Congress can take on at once. Climate change and healthcare are two major issues that can't be resolved overnight. As time wears on, the talks are shaping up for an outcome that looks more like the failed Kyoto climate agreement from a decade ago. After Kyoto, Congress refused to join the rest of the world in capping carbon emissions. Atsi fears that could happen again.
The healthcare debate at the present moment is occupying all the political oxygen in Washington, and that means there's really nothing left with which to drive forward the response to climate change. And as a result, our negotiators will go to Copenhagen without any real game plan in place for how the United States is going to step up and be a constructive part of the response to the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
A lot of people say the U.S. needs to pass a climate change law before going to Copenhagen, but others say maybe not. They argue it's not a bad idea for the U.S. to go into global climate talks without a law because it could allow negotiators to be more flexible. Regardless of how it's done, cutting greenhouse gases is now more pressing than ever before. With Washington paralyzed by the healthcare debate, the timing is just bad for climate change.
If there were ever a time, you can say that about healthcare and about climate policy.
That's energy analyst Randy Udall. He says President Obama has a lot on his plate and should be ready to compromise.
Obama's not going to get nearly as much as many of us had hoped for in terms of health care reform. And he's not going to get nearly as much as many of us had hoped for in terms of energy policy. He will get something, but it's not going to be a half a loaf. It'll be a quarter of a loaf.
Pundits say President Obama is putting all his political chips in the fight for health care. And if he loses, he'll have almost nothing left to spend on climate change. For the Environment Report, I'm Conrad Wilson.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Award-winning playwright James Still is my guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He joins me to talk about his play, The Heavens Are Hung in Black. The play was commissioned by Ford's Theater to celebrate the renovation of the theater and the bicentennial of Abraham Lincoln's birth. The Heavens Are Hung in Black focuses on the months between the death of Lincoln's son, Willie, and the delivery of the Emancipation Proclamation. James Still is visiting the University of Illinois as part of the campus's Lincoln Bicentennial events. And this evening, actors from the Department of Theater will present scenes from the play, and the playwright will discuss the process of characterizing Lincoln so as to offer contemporary audiences a glimpse into the person who was our 16th president. Teaching Abe to dance, researching, and dreaming a character to life will be presented at 7:30 in the Choral Rehearsal Room at the Kraner Center for the Performing Arts. James Still is playwright in residence at the Indiana Repertory Theater. His work has been awarded many honors, including a nomination for a Pulitzer Prize. Next spring, the Station Theater will produce his new play, The Velvet Rut. James Still, welcome. Thanks so much. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
This was such a tall order.
It was.
How did you approach it?
Very carefully, very slowly in many ways. I was commissioned in 2005, but the thing about a commission like this is that when it's commissioned for an event, we knew this play was going to open in February of 2009, and Lincoln's birthday was not going to change. So I had to write this play, and it had to open in February of 2009. 2005, that sounds like a long time ago, but with a play like this, I spent 2 years reading, researching, just starting at zero, trying not to come at the play with any kind of an agenda. Ford's happily didn't give me a long list of things that I had to do or couldn't do in the play. Mm-hmm. It was up to me to decide even what to focus on. So I went at this with an open heart, really, and spent those years reading, taking notes. And at the end of those couple of years, I laid out all my research on it, filled a couple of rooms in an apartment, and started to look where was the overlap, where did things start to make personal sense to me, what was I excited by. I really had to start with just what interested me, what did I want to spend more time on with Lincoln.
And what about the man did you find most interesting and really that set you then to work writing?
Well, many things. One of the things I did was I went back and I read many of his speeches. It was one of the first things that I did. And what I learned in reading his speeches, a couple of important things. One was that he was a great writer. That was good and also challenging. I wanted to write something that was as good as his speeches, so that was one thing. Another thing was that he was a poet. He used imagery. He used metaphor, and I was interested in that, and that started to give me ideas about what kind of play this might be. I also was interested about how he laid out his arguments on the page in a speech, how he would in a roundabout way sometimes come back to an idea that he would start in the beginning, and he might start with an image or a metaphor, and later on he would create idea from that.
He was a good teacher for you.
He was. He was a very good teacher. He also loved Shakespeare. That was another big clue. He could recite long passages of Shakespeare by heart. So that here was a man who loved language. And the other thing, a couple other things that were key was that he was an insomniac. And this idea of the president of the United States knocking around in the middle of the night, reciting Shakespeare. He was also somebody who believed in the meaning of dreams. He would have these dreams and would interpret them. And the 1860s was a time where people were giving a lot of meaning to the supernatural and the meaning of dreams. And so all of that fed into the tone of the play. And so in many ways, the play takes place in Lincoln's conscience. It's really, what does he dream about? Mm. Who visits him? Who does he seek counsel from? So he's visited by the ghosts of John Brown, Dred Scott, Stephen Douglas, who, of course, all have very passionate, intense, different points of view about slavery and about the meaning of that in our country. And
yeah.
So it was a long, arduous process. The other thing that was interesting for me was that once I got into the actual writing, I actually left the country. I moved to Italy for 4 months. I found, for whatever reasons, that I needed to leave the country to write about the country. Part of that was about distraction. Part of it was just about a kind of quiet part of it was I wanted to go someplace that didn't know as much about Abraham Lincoln so that I wasn't facing that every day.
Yeah.
And it's where I did my deepest writing. I rented a little house in Tuscany and lived there for 4 months and wrote and wrote and wrote.
Did you have conversations with Italians about Abraham Lincoln?
You know, they wanted to know what I was doing, and some, of course, you know, everyone knows Abraham Lincoln, knows something about him, but, they were interested in what I was doing, but I didn't feel like they had a lot of opinions about it, whereas, you know, in this country, obviously, if you tell someone you're writing about Lincoln, everybody knows something about Lincoln. I probably knew the least about him, so I was starting in a disadvantage in that way.
Yeah. Where can we see this play in its entirety?
Right now, it's running at the Indiana Repertory Theater in Indianapolis. The website is www.irtlive.com, and it runs through Sunday, October 25th. It's a beautiful new production. As you mentioned, it opened at Ford's in Washington in February and ran there in February and March, broke all box office records. It's a current nominee for the Pulitzer, and now the second production is running at Indiana Rep.
Wow, okay. And the reviews that I have read are fabulous.
Yeah, we did very well. And again, trying to surprise audiences. I mean, as you can imagine, one of the things about Abraham Lincoln is how much more do we really want to know about Abraham Lincoln? And also getting past that idea of him being this iconic, cultural, perfect hero. But in fact, he was a flawed human being. And the play really tries to, I think, at its most successful, it's really about the humanity of Lincoln and just the awful situation that he found himself and as he was trying to lead our country. So in many ways, I think the play is about a style of leadership, which was deeply personal and tortured.
Yeah.
You know?
And at the same time, he has the death of his son, Willie, to contend with,
yeah,
plus the death of so many,
yes,
soldiers,
yeah,
and civilians.
Yeah.
And things don't look good for a very, very long time.
Right.
And then he's got to sort out, does he want to go through with the Emancipation Proclamation?
Mm.
How does a man deal with all this?
Well, as you can imagine, as a writer, that's exactly why as difficult as that is, it's why I was drawn to it. It was the very human aspect of how do we deal with those huge issues, issues of the heart, issues of the conscience. I think that the fact that his son had just died in some ways made him, you know, he was a father and he was the father of the country, and he felt losses for all of them. You know, there's the phrase, controversial now, but that Lincoln was called the great emancipator. I've come to know him as the great empathizer, that he was someone who really felt pain and felt other people's loss as he has experienced it himself. And I wanted to explore that very private Lincoln and that very public Lincoln, that he was a grieving father and husband as well as a leader who is being tried and challenged every day.
Tell us a little bit about how the presentation this evening will unfold.
Sure. It's going to be a casual presentation. I'll be talking honestly about how I worked on the play, what some of the challenges were, how it is you find a voice for Abraham Lincoln, how do you bring to life a character that everybody thinks they know everything about. Mm-hmm. And then we'll read a couple of scenes from the play to sort of give examples as well.
Playwright James Still is my guest this afternoon here on the program. What was it like for you as a playwright and someone who loves the theater, learning, discovering, thinking about Abraham Lincoln as a man who found great solace and pleasure in the theater?
Well, one way is that there's a wonderful scene that starts the second act where Lincoln, on a rainy night, stumbles into a theater where a rehearsal is happening. And it's a rehearsal for Shakespeare's play Henry VI, which is about war. And the star is Edwin Booth, John Wilkes Booth's brother. And so there's a wonderful scene where he meets this company of actors. He waits out the rain, and there's a conversation about the meaning of Shakespeare. It's quite comedic. And at the end of it, Lincoln recites a very famous speech from the play, which is about the king leading his country through war. And seeing Abraham Lincoln take on that very simply without performing it, but just saying those words, it is chilling and heart-stopping.
James Still, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. I look forward to seeing this play.
Thank you so much.
Playwright James Still is the author of The Heavens Are Hung in Black. This evening, actors from the University of Illinois Department of Theater will present scenes from the play, and the playwright will discuss the process of characterizing Lincoln so as to offer contemporary audiences a glimpse into the person who was our 16th president, teaching Abe to dance, researching, and dreaming a character to life will be presented at 7:30 this evening in the Choral Rehearsal Room at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. James Still is playwright in residence at the Indiana Repertory Theater, where you can see The Heavens Are Hung in Black through this October 25th.
Earth and Sky.
In the mid-20th century, scientific advances in agriculture dramatically increased food production. These advances also staved off widespread famine and allowed the world's population to grow. But a new study suggests that food production isn't increasing as rapidly now. This trend could exacerbate hunger around the world.
What we're detecting here and in the U.S., elsewhere in the world, is that the rate of growth in these yields in the last decade and a half, is substantially lower than it has been in the previous three or four decades.
You're listening to Philip Pardee,